I'm Pat Schoen, and I'm happy to be with you. This is going to be a hard act to follow. Those were excellent presentations, and certainly the two presentations on problem solving and job satisfaction lead right into some of the things I'm going to be talking about. I'm not going to be presenting a formal research study, although I'm going to be presenting some results of research, some of my own, some comments from some other researchers. Cindy's my colleague, she's not here, have no relationships to disclose. I've been interested in this topic since 1966, when as a new graduate, I took my first job as a staff nurse and worked for a very abusive head nurse. She didn't like the way I breathed, and there wasn't a lot I could do about that. All of the nurses on the unit were on Valium, prescribed by the nice surgeons on the unit. This is a different time and place, obviously. When she went on summer vacation to Europe and was gone and I was acting head nurse, we all went off our Valium. When she came back, we all went back on our Valium. So certainly there is a long history of incivility or interpersonal abuse in the nursing workforce and healthcare workforce, and if you look at historical data, it goes back a couple hundred years at least. So, first I want to talk about identifying the barriers to developing and maintaining a healthy workplace community. And my research on abuse has been in the academic environment. And there's a lot in the acute care literature. There's really little in the public health literature. I haven't found anything. So I'm going to be kind of trying to say it's there, we just haven't researched it yet. We haven't acknowledged it. So how can we develop and maintain a healthy workplace community? First of all, we have to look at how people are socialized. And when I was working in my doctoral program in sociology back in the 80s, I was studying socialization of women and women in the workforce and socialization in professions. And the research there said that there were two very powerful socializing agencies for role expectations and performance. And they were your first professional degree and your first year of professional employment. And I would add to that personal life experiences. In the research that I did at the university, that Cindy and I did, and we were in a private women's Catholic university, okay, in the Midwest, over 50% of our respondents said they had experienced or observed interpersonal abuse in their personal lives. So we're dealing with a lot of victims and perpetrators also. And we did have data on who said they were perpetrators and who said they were victims. In this research study, we didn't really look at that very much in our research study, but it's there. Okay, so thinking in terms of socialization in the workforce, and my thesis is that if we've got nurses who are perpetrators and victims in the work environment, that we socialize them to that in the academic environment. And I have 37 years of teaching experience, 27 of that in nursing, some in sociology, some in public health. I'm very convinced that it exists in the academic nursing environment. So the research that does exist in the academic environment, students report experiencing or observing interpersonal abuse. Students of color report being alienated and have a much higher rate of reporting interpersonal abuse, incivility. In the clinical situation, students report experiencing or observing interpersonal abuse between and among staff, students, preceptors, and clinical faculty. Having your clinical faculty person and the staff nurses on the unit yell at each other is not a healthy environment for students. It's very frightening. And in the workplace, the primary reason that new graduates leave, and this is primarily acute care, leave the workplace is because of interpersonal abuse. And I've certainly seen that among students I've taught over the years where they've contacted me after graduation with their sad stories and what should I do, you know. So this comes from Cindy's and my study in this private college, Catholic Women's University. I'll just share this with you because it's some of the only data available. We have not been able to publish yet because even though we did go through IRB and I am the primary investigator, the university does not want us to publish the data. How about we talk about it at conferences all the time? So what do you do? Okay, so this is just a... a small sample of our data. 77% of the respondents were students. We only had a 35% response rate. This was using SurveyMonkey. So we can't generalize even to our own university, but we can say this presents a kind of a red flag. The people that reported the highest incidence of experiencing or observing abuse were students. You could see 411, close to 80%, and then compare that to faculty, administration, and staff who responded. And then if you looked at, and I'm sorry, I have to see the screen over here because my vision doesn't get me as far as that. If you look at what programs, there's 17 health professions programs at this university, and it was primarily health professions survey, you can see that nursing far outpaced any other department as far as reporting interpersonal abuse. Okay, so this became a nursing department problem, if you will. The most common abusive behaviors reported were constant complaining, blaming, favoritism, cursing, demeaning. I mean, we had one student write in about watching students on the floor wrestling with each other and pulling each other's hair. So you get to that level. But most of it is a little less physical than that. Who is the most victimized in this study? And we did a couple of studies. In this study, it was students. The previous study was students. When we asked them who were the primary victimizers in this study, it was students to students. And when we asked them who was the most caring and compassionate, it was faculty, which was nice to see. That was not true in our previous study. It was the reverse. Well, where did students say abuse occurred? Now, if you look at this, we have 10% about occurred outside the major, 24% inside the major, and the majority of students who responded were nursing students. And then you have about 7% in other places on campus. That's clinical. 7.7%, and then 19.3% other places on campus. And 40% said they didn't experience or observe any abuse, but keep in mind 80% of the nursing students reported it. So this number is much lower when you look overall, but if you look at nurses, it was much higher. But this data convinced the administration that it was a campus-wide problem, not just a nursing problem. Okay. And then this was of concern. 20% of the respondents said they did not feel safe or weren't sure if they were safe in the academic environment. Again, this is a private Catholic women's college. Not what you would expect. We asked them how abuse affected them, and we asked about their jobs. We asked about their school performance, dropout rates, and so forth. And it got a lot of positive correlation there, but the slide I brought with me is just looking at the health effects, and you can see a lot of somatizing. 12.5% said yes, this abuse did affect their health. A small survey I did with a group of nurses at a conference was 25% said that abuse in their work environments caused healthcare problems. And in a Minnesota collaborative that I work with that's interdisciplinary, we've brought in people from HR, and we brought in people from the insurance industry, and this has become a very hot topic, because if employers are paying their employees insurance and their employees are out of work and going to the doctor or in the hospital receiving medical treatment, this significantly increases the insurance costs for the employer. So this has become a huge issue recently in many healthcare settings. Okay. So we've talked about the academic environment, the prior work experience. Research shows that 90% of healthcare workers report experiencing or observing harmful behaviors. 27 to 85%, and I've actually seen it higher than this in older studies, of nurses reported being bullied or harassed or experiencing incivility. And 38 to 60% of new grads change employment within the first year of work. And remember, the primary reason they leave is experiencing interpersonal abuse. So these are the people you get in your health departments. They come out of the academic institutions where there is abuse, and they come out of probably acute care where there is a lot of abuse. So you are hiring perpetrators and victims. Okay. And then the question is, well, did they know how to create and maintain a healthy environment? Okay. There is a cycle of victimization that probably you're probably familiar with, but it's kind of like once a victim, always a victim. It's very hard to get out of that cycle, especially if you bring it in from your personal life. And so it just continues, and perpetrators like to pick on victims. Okay. Common examples of workplace incivility. I checked this list with my daughter, who's a psych nurse, and she said, "Oh, Mom, I do interrupt others and I do gossip." Okay. The other things, she was some of that, she said, "You mean they really do that?" She's in a pretty good work culture environment. But she's, well, the patients yell and scream, but the nurses don't really. And I said, "In psych, you'd expect that, I guess." Okay. So some of the contemporary stresses in public health that might make our staff respond in a less than civil or healthy manner to each other. This severe feeling of powerlessness has been documented. Work overload has been documented, and those studies are old. I'm sure it would be worse right now. And then colleagues' negative attitudes due to changes in the external environment and the inadequate administrative support. And again, I'm sure that's with more recent studies, it's worse. So kind of to summarize it, we have the ongoing change from the external and the internal environment, the level of complexity of the work and the patients and clients we work with, lack of support well documented at the supervisory, team, management, and administrative levels, and in public health we could surmise there's probably lack of support out in the community with cuts in funding. Reduction in funding and staffing, and then interpersonal abuse and incivility. All of these would add stress, and you could assume that the yellow, green, and blue blocks would cause some of the incivility also. So you've got people who are already socialized to incivility, working in an environment that is stressful. Okay. So then we want to look at what do they bring to the table as far as competencies to deal with this. And leadership, collaboration, and communication, I'm at 5 minutes, okay, have been identified as entry-level competencies for public health nursing. So what do they bring to the table when they're hired? Okay, leadership, I've identified 4 types of leadership that I think are common in the new grads: the organizational leadership, transactional leadership, okay, let's take care of this today, it's a problem today, let's deal with it, do they have that? Shared leadership, let's work as a team to solve our problems. Your new grads bring in that. And then servant leadership, is there more concern for the well-being of the team than the well-being of the individual nurse? There are entry-level public health nursing skills that we've identified in the manual that was alluded to that I'm a co-author of. We have identified through the evidence in the literature entry-level public health nursing leadership skills. And so some of these you can see would really help a lot to resolving conflict in the work environment. Collaboration, the definition actually from the Public Health Nursing Intervention Wheel, working together to achieve a common goal through enhancing the capacity of one or more of the members and to promote and protect health. Obviously that, if they were able to collaborate, that would help to reduce conflict or resolve it or manage it. And then there are best practices in collaboration, like commitment of the participants, shared values, effective team leadership, being able to link, identifying strategies and resources, and internal systems that would support resolving problems. Effective communication skills, this comes from a recent article by Kelly. If you look at these, things like silence, reassuring, humor, conveying acceptance, responding, clarifying, confronting, supporting, these are all good communication skills for resolving conflict. And if you know about studies of how nurses and nursing educators deal with conflict, we primarily deal with it by avoidance and denial. Okay, so we need a little, so if that's what they're getting from their faculty, you know. Okay, so what organizational attributes do we need to maintain a healthy workplace community? This comes from the manual again, after working with my colleagues who are both in practice and in academia. We came up with this model, which is you need at all levels, you need leadership that provides support. And your entry-level PHN is coming in at the staff level, but after they're there for a while, obviously they're going to need and notice the availability of management or administrative support. So you need all 3 parts of the organization working together to develop this healthy work environment. And then these are just, whoops, sorry, went the wrong direction. Some of the structures that support public health nursing practice from Underwood. Good management practices, organizational vision, flexibility in all things, strong leadership to promote public health, support the values, support their staff's work, and invest in their staff and education. Staff need to be able to share the vision, work collaboratively. They also need flexibility and more access to continuing education. And the workshops and conferences I've done related to this issue, and I think we've done three so far, everybody that comes to the workshop says we need more in conflict management. They want help in that area. You've already talked about job satisfaction, so I won't belabor this, but the things that people talked about earlier, obviously if you have lack of job satisfaction, you have people leaving, you have people that kind of do the time but not the work, and they don't invest in problem solving. So, what can we do to promote a healthy workplace environment? Well, three approaches I found in the literature, and I'm not going to go into them, but I thought presented interesting models. The first one comes from education, the use of an empowerment model, and then the second one comes from how to help students resolve conflict and insecurity in the environment. And the third one is your traditional, how do you orient and work with new grads. So you want to create a culture of civility by building trust, by being aware of the problems, by dealing with them, by think of primary prevention, identifying things early that cause problems, maintaining, if you're going to change something, maintain the momentum until there is change, so forth. And I'm just going to go through that. I did have 20 handouts. If anybody wants these slides, they're in the back table. So we worked on using an action research model at this university, cross-disciplinary, top-down, bottom-up commitment. We involved everybody at all levels in the organization, including students. We tried to embed it in the process and the ongoing work of the organization. We were able to embed it in the curriculum. We're not able to embed it yet in HR and job descriptions and so forth. We identified what we needed to do to be successful, to have openness, 100% engagement, a committed core, communication, and policy development that was transparent, clear, equitable, people adhered to it. Okay. There needed to be ground rules at all levels in the organization. And so at the individual level of faculty, students, staff, we used a process of identifying behaviors that were healthy and then those that were harmful, how people wanted to be approached if they experienced harmful behaviors. That is important for faculty and students, but faculty primarily, to model healthy behaviors, and education at all levels on conflict management. And so you could kind of see this looks like the public health model, student, system, and community. So these are the things we did and are still doing. At the student-faculty level, developing posters that were posted, had education on horizontal and vertical violence for teachers, faculty, students, staff. Did classroom activities to identify the sort of behaviors students thought was harmful, helpful, and what they wanted to do about it. Created pamphlets for students and faculty, separate pamphlets on working in teams and how to be healthy. Climate logs at the institutional level, making sure we had diversity in our core team. That was across disciplines. That was ethnic, racial, gender, whatever, and all levels. We wanted it to be part, the work in this area to be part of the academic load and included in performance review. That has not happened. We are partnering with human resources. Sharing survey results, we were able to do that within the university. And when we had conferences, anybody who came, we shared the results. I'm sharing them now. Okay. And then right early on, we developed a much better resource list, both within the university and within the community, for support for people who were victimized. And for faculty and staff to know where to refer victims to. And then doing conferences with our community partners, bringing in experts, working together. And so our lessons learned. It's an ongoing journey. Change does not occur overnight. It takes time, energy, and commitment, but things can improve. The climate of the organization impacts workforce recruitment and retention, student recruitment and retention, and the quality and productivity of everybody's work. So it impacts everything. Okay. And that's my presentation, and I hope it's given you some ideas about what you might want to think about, particularly with your younger staff and probably your older staff, because there are things going on in our organizations. Okay, thank you.